Yes. Music by David Morneau, our guest today on Calvos and Damien
in the house.
As his collage number one, Hungarian. Familiar tunes in that.
Was there any resistance from the orchestra players to something like that?
Not publicly. I don't know if there was any grumbling behind, you know, after rehearsal about it or not, but the couple of kids that talked to me really liked it. I think a lot of them didn't sort of get that it was this other source material.
Yes.
Until the very end when they saw the program.
Notes. I understand that. I had some misgivings when I was there many years earlier.
What was the name of that piece of yours, that suite?
The one piece that I had, I was not allowed to put it in the program, was a Crapsody for orchestra, which was completely tunes from other, quotes from other pieces.
Yes,
but
yes.
I had to rename it because in those days I couldn't even put that on the program. It was too slanderous. Yes.
We'll have to play that at some point.
Maybe.
Let's talk about length.
Okay.
You are the master of the short form. And not just the 365 year. You seem to be very focused on a limited number of materials in a very compact time frame.
Okay. Yes.
Unless you aren't.
No, I think that's true.
Well, in other words, in the kind of non-pop field, there's this sort of whole range of composers who go for the long, grand gesture. And I'm not seeing that kind of long gesture in your music. And is that a choice you've made because you simply don't like it, you don't aspire to it, you think it's, you have some negative sense about it, or you just prefer simply the compact form?
It's a preference, but I think it's more just I'm better suited to the compact form. I've always been a very concise kind of guy. I like to tell people, you know, in school, you take the essay test and you have write a 500 word essay to answer. You know, and there's a question at 250 words in, and I've answered it, so then I have to go back and repeat 250 words just to make it 500. But I've always just kind of felt very comfortable in, you know, short and to the point. Things that don't develop. I mean, I guess I do a lot of development, but I don't like to make this big, long thing. Just say what I want to say and then be done with it. I think the limited materials thing was a result of training. My first composition professor, Richard Stewart, when I was at Cornerstone, was a big Bach guy. And so in all of our lessons, in all of our classes, we would analyze Bach. And he would point out the way there's like this little, here's this four-note motif. And that's all he uses to build the piece. And so that really stuck with me. And that was the thing I was always trying to do then. Of course, I was trying to do it like Bach did it, which, it's never going to happen. But just that idea of, like, what can I do with a little bit rather than throwing everything into it and seeing what comes out has always appealed to me.
You have some questions about
video.
On
your website, there are some just excellent videos.
Thank you.
Oh, they're just so much fun, and I encourage everyone to go to your website, which is
5of4.com.
And those are numerals.
Right, the number 5, the word of, the number 4.com.
Where you will find lots of entertaining bits, and the one video that really I gravitated towards was the means, because it shows your life in the OSU, the OSU book depository.
Oh, yes. That was actually my first video ever.
Really? It's brilliant.
Thank you.
Have you seen it, Calvos?
I have not. I will go look.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, I was, part of my studies at the Ohio, I had to take courses outside of music. And so I took some video classes from this guy named Dan Schellenberger, who was really interested in just letting you do whatever you wanted to do. So I thought, well, I'm going to see if I can think about video the way I think about music. And that video was, after my day at the book depository, which was this giant warehouse of books that don't circulate very often, I just filmed myself working. And then I put the book, the camera on a cart and wheeled it past rows of books to get this sort of dolly effect. And I just layered it. And so I had this nice moment of three of me working on these repetitive tasks all at once.
And the music that you wrote for it was?
Oh, that music, that was actually something I wrote while I was at Western Michigan University. It's just a this sort of angst-ridden piece. For
yeah, it
band.
Fits beautifully.
Angst-ridden
it's
piece.
It's called
Ren.
Moan.
Oh.
Let's hear another. Well, let's see. Shall we do a couple short ones, or do you want to do "Where Is Tokyo" now?
We could do "Where Is Tokyo."
Let's listen to that. This is talking about expansive pieces. This is a little bit more expansive than your usual. Give us a little introduction to this piece.
This was a collaboration with the dancer, and she likes to do things that are a little bit different than the way everybody else does things. So, this was at Ohio State. And she opted, instead of using the performance stage, to use a rehearsal studio. And in the process of developing that, basically what she wanted to do with the piece is you get the audience, an audience of two comes in and sits in this set, and you look through this window, and there's this sort of constructed set, and then there's also this projected set.
So it's two-dimensional and three-dimensional.
Right. And the projected set was made in 3D animation software, so it moves around, and it's this whole bizarre thing. And we were talking about ways to sort of incorporate the idea of space into the music, not outer space, but physical space. And so there were two layers to the sound. The one that you're not going to hear was just recordings of duct work and, you know, air conditioning, because the room had a lot of that anyway. So we made our own layers of that that shifted. And then I made a little soundtrack, which is just like this homemade recording of a piano piece that I wrote. And I just cut that apart to make it this sort of expansive thing. And we played that, rather than blasting it through a big PA system, we played it on a boombox and put that off to the side so that when you're watching the piece, you get the sense that the music is really off to the right and the other sounds are off to the left and the dancer is moving through all of this.
Let's hear it, and we'll come back and talk a little bit about what it's like to work with dancers. Our guest today is David Morneau. This is Where Is Tokyo?
Thank you.
Where is Tokyo? Music by David Morneau, our guest today on Calvus and Damien.
In the house.
I hope that you'll somehow allow our listeners to see the images, so you can somehow put that on the website.
Oh, I will certainly do that.
Oh, good.
Yes, absolutely. Now, let's talk about these dancer people. What is it about working with dancers? What's it like to do that, and what can you get away with? And yeah, the composer, what's the whole dance world do for you?
Well, it's great because it gives me a concept and a slight direction, so I don't have to come up with an idea for a piece from scratch. But at the same time, it's loose enough. Generally, it's loose enough about what they want that I can go a lot of directions or explore a lot of things. And I've been fortunate that the dancers I've worked with have been really interested in collaborating, so I can bring in an idea that might fundamentally change the piece, and they're at least open to discussing it.
What's the process? I mean, do they say you briefly explain Sunshine and Dirt,
right.
but very briefly in a piece like this, how do you work? Do you bring bits and pieces of it along? Do you watch their sketches? Do you work out bits and pieces at the same time as you're looking at them? How does that work?
It's different with everybody, but. To generalize, there is a lot of I'll make a sketch or short idea to give them a sense of kind of the tone of the piece and the sounds I want to use. And I'll bring that in, and sometimes they'll just listen to it, and sometimes they'll listen and try it with movement that they've already made. Sometimes they'll listen to it and then make movement to it, and there'll be discussion from there. Sometimes they'll say, I have this piece that I want you to score, and then you go in and they have the whole thing, all the dance is done, all the movement is essentially done, and they want me to score to it. But modern dance, they don't necessarily, they don't need the music to align perfectly with the movement. So, you know, as long as at 3 minutes the tone changes to this, and at 6 minutes it goes back to that or whatever, then I can kind of do, I don't have to worry about things lining up so nicely. So basically I just go home and write 3 minutes of this and 3 minutes of that and connect them and bring it back in. But yeah, there's a lot of back and forth, a lot of bringing, you know, sitting in rehearsal, watching their stuff. They listen to what I've done, trying the music and the movement together and seeing, you know, if it works, if it doesn't work, how do we fix it? And sometimes it's, I go home and do something from scratch. Sometimes it's I go home and adjust. Sometimes like, I really like what you've done, so they're going to adjust to me, which is always a nice day when that happens.
Is that a frequent? It's not a frequent day with Damien. Yeah. You've worked for dancers. It seems that they have had their way with you and your music.
But that's been a long time. Long time ago. Dancers are different now.
Yes. Well, and I think partly that part of the relationship comes out of the fact that we were all in school at the same time, so we were more peers than I suspect now if somebody just hired me to do it, there would be less of them adjusting to me and a lot more of me adjusting to them. But so far I'm just working with friends. So
what is it you're working on now? You were mentioning that after the 365-day piece, you jumped right into writing a commission.
Well, whatever it was done. Let me think. Yeah. I had to do... I did a short piece with a dancer, and then I got hired to score some videos, which is not music you want to listen to without the video. But there's a guy in Washington, D.C. who does a lot of he did a video for a group called Shared Hope. So we did some music to go with a video about training cops, about the sex slave industry.
Is this electroacoustic? Kind of is this sampled music? What do you, how do you work that sort of thing out?
That they really want, in that case, in a lot of those kinds of videos, the client really wants it to sound like a movie. So they want orchestral instruments, but we don't. There's no budget for that. So you get a really nice, I have Motu symphonic instrument or whatever it is, and I plug my MIDI into that and then add some reverb. And when you turn it down in the background, it sounds enough like real instruments. Mm-hmm. So it's not real, it's synthesized, I guess it'd be.
And now, what at the moment, what are you working on?
I've got a collaboration with a dancer that will be. It's a series of variations on a drum sample called the Amen Break. The Amen Break is it's a drum break from a song that was written in, or recorded in 1969 by a band called the Winstons. They had one hit. And they won a Grammy and it went to number one, and it was a piece called Color Him Father. This is back, it was a 45. So on the B side, they had this other throwaway track called Amen Brother, which is just this cheesy little instrumental. really an insignificant recording, except for the fact that in the 80s, the producer of a series called Ultimate Breaks and Beats, which is a series of LP releases for DJs where they just go back and they sample from all these, you know, funk songs and soul songs from the 70s, that producer unearthed this and put it on, you know, this vinyl series for DJs to use. And that became, right away, it was a big track or a big sample in gangsta rap. And then from there, like, it hit the rave scene and then, you know, jungle and drum and bass. Actually, jungle drum and bass is built around, essentially the entire movement is built around this one drum break, which I find fascinating. So I've been working with that to make a series of little vignettes. And then, you know, the dancer is creating movement to those, and we're going to create some projected video to go on top of the whole thing when we're done.
And is this working kind of in the same principles? You bring some material along, or is this more your driven idea or dancer driven? How is this working out?
We've completed three of them so far. And the first two were very much, I made the music and brought it to her and she just choreographed to it. The third one that we just finished, we sort of worked hand in hand on. I had some ideas for the music and she had some ideas for movement, and we worked it out until we got to a place where we could make it work together. I know that the next one or two are going to be dancer driven. She's got some movement that she's made. So after the holidays, I'm going to go into the studio with her and watch it and see what that makes me want to do with the sample.
What's your day job? Do you actually do composition for film and such and survive at it?
No.
Okay then. I thought we had a rare one here we could learn from.
Okay. Well, I don't have a day job. I mean, music is, I freelance and do, you know, these little gigs. I'm looking for a part-time day job right now. The secret to my financial success is that I have a wife who works at it. She got a great job, and she's very happy to work and let me compose, as long as I start bringing in a little bit more money. But she's great. She's very supportive, and she just loves that we're doing this, and she loves that we moved to New York for this. And so that's my secret. That doesn't work for everybody, though.
Is she possibly a musician?
She's a theater person.
Much better.
That's why she can write things like David Morneau does not compose his music with a poetic power that emphatically
does
charge.
That's not my wife.
Oh.
That's my little sister.
That's your little sister.
You didn't get the sibling tension in there?
No, I didn't get this. Well, that explains it even more. Uh-huh.
Yes, she writes my bios and she designs my T-shirts.
What is your T-shirt?
I didn't see the T-shirt.
Wait, no. Oh, yeah, that's a new thing. I have through a site called screens.com, you can go and buy shirts. So she's done three for me. One's got a drawing of my face on it. One's got a drawing of a clam shell or like an oyster shell with a little whole note inside of it. And one of them's got a martini glass with whole notes for olives.
And no island of Dr. Morneau. What is wrong here?
That will be the next one.
It must be.
I'm going to insist that she does an island theme next.
Let's hear another tune.
Sure.
What's a good one to hear? Actually, a couple that I kind of found fascinating, and I'd like to know a little bit more about them, are both Dancing DNA and Zero Dance.
Okay.
Tell us about Dancing DNA to start with.
Dancing DNA was a woman named Susan Fisher, who is the is a sort of insane biology professor at Ohio State. She's the kind of person who enjoys doing the 500 student freshman biology lecture class. And one of the things she does is she works with artists and musicians and dancers to find ways to sort of communicate biological concepts in other media. And I came into this project pretty late, but it was another, it was like a video dance piece about DNA. And so it starts with two dancers with these long sleeves that represent DNA, I guess. I don't really remember the, I don't remember the science of it very well. And then they split, and then there's four of them at the end. So it's all about cell division.
See, I was curious because I listened to the piece and I said, it does not sound like you were using a genetic algorithm to produce this.
No.
Okay, okay. I was a little concerned there because I thought I was missing something.
No. It was just me doing it by hand.
Our guest is David Morneau. Here's Dancing DNA. Thank you. My DNA is all uncoiling here. My double helix is undoing. I'm just how about you?
The algorithms were really cooking, I thought.
Oh, they were cooking. Dancing DNA, the strands just going all over the room. Music by David Morneau here on Calvos and Damien.
In the house.
Now, your music is easy to listen to, by and large. At least some of it. Not all of the 365s are, but you don't seem to have a...
Wait, that's a little subjective, don't you think?
Of course it's subjective. That's why we're getting to the question.
Oh, all right.
Do you have a feeling about yourself and your music that it's that way? You said earlier on that you're a little laid back, and do you make your music that way? Do you feel your music is kind of a direct communication to your audiences and not a confrontational communication? How do you approach that?
It's not something I've thought about too much. I think part of it is a reaction to
your Darmstadt influence.
Right. Reaction to like music that's not easy to listen to, or music that's easy and difficult are kind of, like you said, subjective, but it's a reaction to things that are overly, you know, kind of whatever.
Like the OSU marching band.
Sure.
Yeah. It is to me. Maybe that's
go
just
ahead,
my
put notes in his mouth.
Oh, never mind.
But there are, like, I have this, I, now that I'm sort of done a lot of things, I want to start doing more, I guess, noisy or kind of intense or difficult or whatever, just to see what that's like and then see where I end up. But I don't think it wasn't really a lot of conscious choice about being approachable or whatever.
I guess I'm just trying to find out that how a person who's come up through a kind of a composition program today is different from one who might have come up through that program during the height of edgy modernism.
I think there's kind of a resignation to the idea that people aren't going to always do the heavy modern stuff. But I think for myself, I like to be the guy in the room who's doing something different. Like, I like to be the one who's different. And so going through, you know, academia, that means doing stuff that borrows pop songs, borrows pop forms, borrows sort of tonality, because that's becoming kind of acceptable.
Oh, well,
again.
That's been acceptable for 40 years now, so.
Right, well, you know, academia is catching up.
Oh, yeah.
It's still a little bit behind, but yeah, but that's even becoming, you know, more acceptable and more kind of accustomed there. But I think, yeah, somebody coming up through that kind of program today is going to be more willing to experiment with more things and probably more openly influenced by sort of the culture around them than they would have been, you know, 20 years ago, even though I suspect everybody was influenced by the culture, but you just sort of put that part of yourself away when you go to your lesson and pull out your cereal, whatever. I don't know. I'm guessing.
It's really interesting because your pieces are, even the ones that are in fact edgy, are completely able to be entered. I guess that's the from my point of view, I don't find any one of them that won't let me into it, which is a really kind of a compliment. And I'm kind of getting at, what is it about what you write that makes that possible? Do you know, or is that just who you are? Or
no, when you say it like that, that makes me – I know one thing I try to do is I know that there's this kind of reputation that modern music has for being difficult and for being obtuse and for being like strange to be strange or whatever. And that, I know that's not always true, and there's a lot of difficult music that I really enjoy, but I know that just handing that to somebody isn't going to get them to listen to it. So I sort of, there's a part of me that always feels like maybe I should evangelize, for lack of a better word.
Please.
And so in my music, that's what I try and do, is to sort of like, present, like, here's modern music, or here's a take on this modern idea, but here's a way that, you know, I'm doing it in a way that hopefully is approachable, or hopefully you can find a way into, and then from there maybe move on to, you know, a Stockhausen or something that's has a reputation for being much more difficult, but is still great to listen to if you, I think, if you have a sort of path to it. So maybe I like to lay a path to things.
No. Let's hear Zero Dance. Short piece, but something about it. It's a funny little piece, isn't it?
Okay.
Tell something about it.
Oh, Zero Dance is another dance collaboration. Excuse me. It's part of a much longer piece, and the entire half hour, 45 minute show was made entirely with a vintage Nintendo Game Boy and a step sequencer called Nano Loop. So one note at a time. I built this one note at a time, and then one loop at a time to build this sort of 8-bit zaniness.
Our guest is David Morneau. This is Zero Dance. Oh, we knew you wanted it. Now you got it. There it is. Music by David Morneau, our guest today on Calvos and Damien.
In the house.
That's Zero Dance. Yes. Yes, that's just. It was just there. It was just there.
Yeah.
What? What?
You must have something.
No.
Oh, well, then I do. See, I'll ask some more serious deadpan guy questions.
Of course.
Let's go back to talking about the 365 project.
Okay.
I know that when I took on my project about the same time as you did, the We Are All Mozart was the name of it, and the idea, the original idea was to write a piece a day on commission. That was the trick, and I couldn't get them. I could only get 100 commissions in the course of a year.
100 commissions is pretty good.
And part of the reason I wanted to do that is
just for the money.
It was no, I wish, you know. I mean, it was cheap. I mean, I wanted something that had this kind of thing that said, we don't have to be precious as composers. we can be productive, we can put ourselves to a task every day and work on it and make it happen, and we can work to somebody else's specifications too. If somebody wants a piece for ukulele, well, they're going to get one. You know, I may have to learn how to write for ukulele, and that's an example because I did.
Right.
And I had to write for jew's harp, and I had to write for accordion, and I had to write for mandocello and tenor guitar and all instruments that I'd never heard of. and I really wanted to sort of get that idea of productivity out there, and like, we could do this stuff. And Damien did this stuff, you know, confronted with 2 weeks, 2.5 weeks to write a score for a play, did it 4 times. Did you have philosophical motive here, or were you just like, it was a cool idea, or did you want to provoke other composers into saying, what the hell are you doing?
I don't think I had that kind of a motive. Actually, I know I didn't have that kind of a motive when I started, even though that is something that is important to me in a way, even though I don't think I thought about that until I discovered your project and saw that there were parallels, but saw the differences in the stated reasons why you were doing it. And then I thought about, it is important to do more than one piece every couple of years and to be able to work. I didn't work to other people's specifications in my project, but just to be able to work quickly and to be able to work in a variety of things and to be able to put it out there. Like I was saying earlier, I knew that not every piece was going to be a masterpiece, but just to be able to do it and put it out there and go to the next one and put it out there and go to the next one, as, you know, maybe that was the statement about it. It's not the individual pieces maybe aren't as important, but, you know, just doing it every day and composing and just being active creatively.
I think we all learned, though, that if you do it enough, you get better. It's like a muscle that you exercise.
Right, exactly. Yeah, so by the end, I felt like less and less sort of weak pieces. Even if there were weak ideas, the pieces didn't feel as sort of tossed off to me.
Hmm.
And I have noticed now that I'm not, you know, I have slipped, I'm not composing every day anymore. I have noticed that it is, you know, it is atrophying a little bit. You know, it is a little harder some days. So the discipline, I have to get that, you know, I think we have the eternal struggle, right, to do it every day. But that's, yeah.
Did anybody get mad at you?
Why? Not that I can remember, no.
I got a lot of hostility to my project.
From people who are steeped in tradition.
Well, from the Webern syndrome composers, the people who, you know, who considered somebody who wrote 7 opus numbers in his lifetime to be the model.
Right. No, I didn't get, at least I'm sure there was that reaction. I didn't get any of that kind of reaction openly. I know after the project was done and there was a little bit more, like it sort of found its way to some other blogs online, there was a few comments about, you know, curiosity about the importance of doing this kind of a thing, or, you know, is it, you know, did I really accomplish the goals I set out to or whatever? And there was like some of that kind of questioning, but not anything, you know, I didn't get any emails or phone calls or, you know, confrontations about, you know, why are you doing this?
Did you accomplish the goals you set out to?
Yeah, I composed more. I completed a piece every day, and those were the two big goals. And, you know, the secondary goal was to try new things in my music, and so I did a lot of that too. But yeah.
What did you learn from it?
I learned how to sort of turn off that part of my mind that was kind of hyper-developed, you know, from academic training, where you sort of try and put everything you do into this, in the perspective of this canon that we have, and try to sort of justify everything and try and determine if what I'm doing is a new enough idea to make it worthwhile, and just to be able to shut that off and just, you know, whatever the idea that I'm happy with right now is good, and that's what I'm going to do. And if somebody else doesn't like it because it's not novel enough or not original enough, then that's fine.
In the process, we talked about, you know, sort of the practice element of it and how you sort of improved. Did you notice that your pieces got more, had more to say inside them, so that in listening back to them, you discover additional layers in the music that you didn't expect were there. And I don't mean sort of layers of sound, but rather layers of contextualization, internal context, internal integrity to the pieces.
That's a good question. I haven't listened back enough to notice that, but I think maybe another way to think about it is I did, as I was going and would go back to, you know, do little listenings or whatever, I would notice certain habits and habits that I didn't like, or like, I don't know how to say it. Like, I guess little practiced ways of doing things. So a little, like, the same solution to the same problem.
Sort of a personal cliche that
had
developed.
Right, yeah, my own little cliche. And so being able to work around those and develop probably new cliches that I haven't,
well, of course,
I haven't recognized yet. But I haven't really spent the time, like, really listening to it. I think because I was tired of it when I was done, and I haven't gone back to do, like, serious listening to see if that kind of thing is there. But I imagine that there probably is some of that.
Were there pieces that you were disappointed to have to stop at 60 seconds? And if there were, have you expanded those in later work?
Yes, there were many pieces that I was disappointed to stop at 60 seconds. And I'm trying to think, I know at least one of them I expanded to a 3-minute piece. It's actually part of the Amen Break project I was referring to earlier. And then there are a couple where I haven't expanded the piece, but I've taken the max patch that I made the piece with and tweaked that, and then I've been making longer pieces that way. So, yeah, it's like this whole catalog of things to go back to and things to go back and work on.
Fascinating project, fascinating pieces. Where are you headed next?
I am not sure. Wherever life takes me, I guess.
Do you still have work on your dissertation?
I still have to, yeah, I have a little work left on my, or a lot of work, I guess, on my dissertation. I'm about a third of the way through the music that I have to write, and a third of the way through the paper that I have to write with it, maybe. I don't know. I haven't really looked at it since about October, so I gotta, after the holidays, get that back out and sort of see my way through that again.
And does a public performance come with it?
Does not have to, no.
Oh.
So it's an electroacoustic piece that is expansions of three of my podcast pieces.
Aha. Excellent use of material.
Right. Well, and the paper is about the project and sort of putting it in context of new media and sort of online communities.
Well, before we wrap up, tell a little bit more about that, those online communities, and how you felt that you helped propel them or were part of them, or they represent some sort of a dynamic change for artists.
I think that, I guess that was the other little kernel of why I wanted to do this, is that, you know, we're confronted with the internet, and I think for a lot of artists, it's really just a way to sort of put your portfolio online. And that's kind of it. And now we have Facebook and MySpace, so you can get on. But even there, you're not really doing anything as an artist. You're just writing on your friends' walls and posting pictures of your life and all these things. And I was interested in thinking about, you know, is there a way to compose, you know, for this medium, I guess. Is there a way to compose for the internet so that the music I was writing would go online as its primary performance? And so, like, here in the studio, this is a second, or here in the living room, I should say, this is a secondary performance of it. And when I send off little 10-minute mixes to, you know, music conferences, those are secondary performances. Mm-hmm. In the same way that traditionally the orchestra performance would be the primary, and then the recording of the orchestra would be the secondary. So for me, putting it online was like the primary way to get it out there, in the primary sort of listening space, so that people would listen through their headphones or on their iPod or in their home or however they wanted to do it. Not all at the same time. So you get this kind of asynchronous sort of concert.
That's really interesting about the asynchronicity, because in previous times, of course, it was highly synchronous before recording technology.
Right.
And then with recording technology, you had some asynchronicity, but there was a really strong radio network concept so that people would hear those pieces all at the same time in their homes.
Right.
And then as you got online, not only was it asynchronous, but the reaction to it was as well, and the feeding of it from place to place was
right.
completely different, completely dynamic.
Yes. Yes, and that was part of the interest for the internet with me. It was just, here's another way to maybe try and get new music into somebody's life, but do it in a way where they don't have to, go out in the snow and go to a concert hall and sit in the dark. They can just, drink their cup of coffee at the end of the day or at the beginning of the day and listen to the 1 minute thing in the context and the comfort of their home, and maybe it's a little safer, maybe it's a little friendlier, and then maybe from there they go and listen to, I don't know, We Are All Mozart or something.
is online the real home for contemporary composition now?
I don't know about that, because I know there's still a lot of live performance. I mean, like especially electroacoustic, there's a lot of performance stuff that's happening, and I think the internet will become a place for new music, but I think a lot of it is still going to be this sort of secondary portfolio or distribution network rather than like composing for that.
Remember that composer I'd met some years ago said to me that he was entirely satisfied with being a relatively unknown composer, because even being relatively unknown, he had been heard by more people than Mozart in his entire lifetime.
Wow. Cool. Well, I could be happy with that too.
Our guest is David Morneau. He did the 60 by 365 project. His website is read this 5of4.com. That's number 5of4.com. Go there. We'll put stuff on the Callis and Damian site as well. And we're going to wrap up with your July. Some July selections.
Yeah, six selections from July.
Give us a little quick précis of what we're going to hear, because kind of really hangs together quite an interesting way. Heavily sampled pieces.
Oh, wow. I see this. Are we doing July or are we doing, June?
We had said July, but we can do June.
I meant June.
Oh, well, then let's go to June.
June is the one that ends the process. There's a piece called Bang, and I'll be honest, I don't remember what that is. But you can go online and see that. The piece called Simple Sign is the eighth in a series of sort of sine wave synthesis pieces I was experimenting with. There's a piece called Robot Dream that somebody made a little FM synthesis sequencing tool that I downloaded and tried. And so I made a little loopy piece called Robot Dream. Then there's a couple of other sort of Max-inspired pieces, one called Etude and one called Lullaby. And then the final piece of the project is on here. It's a piece called At Last, which is a collage of musical endings.
Excellent. How appropriate.
David Morneau, thanks so much for being our guest today on Calvos and Damian
in
the house.
Thanks for having me. It's been fun.
Here we go. Some pieces from June 2008. Go listen to them all.
Yeah,
it's really worth it.